will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I just can't take no pleasure in killing. Just some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
There's nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
Let her get away, Mommy.
Welcome to another edition of Horrifying My Friends. I'm horror host Trav. Joining me, as always, is producer Kate.
Hello.
And returning to the show is Brian Brooks.
Good day, kind of people.
So we are still on kind of this quarantine cast of characters here. The people that were basically, if one of us has it, then we all have it. So we're all fucked.
Let's fucking go, bud.
So Brooks returns, and it's been a long time since you've been on here. Yes.
Yep. I'm on the band No Fly List.
And I was thinking about this. Yeah. And I was thinking about this earlier, but we've come a long way, like from that first Psycho episode where me and you were kind of just sitting like, what do we do? Like just looking at each other. But like, I was like, man, we should really like think about returning at least to the original. Like we should return to Bates Motel at some point, like me and you.
Oh,
either
yeah.
By doing the original again, or by doing the second one, or by doing the remake.
Like, I think we even talked about dipping into the series a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
We definitely talked about it at that point. Like, we need to do another version of...
Oh, for sure. And I even think...
Go see Norman again.
It would be even fun to do the original again. Because, like, we had no clue what we were doing the first time. And it would be fun to just, like, dive in again and do it.
Instead of just being a couple jackasses sitting around talking about the movie.
We literally had no clue what we were going to do or talk about or anything like that.
Right.
But, anyway, how have you guys been? Like, how have you been, man?
Things are good. You know, I'm not really too excited. Nothing too exciting going on right now. You know, just working and being home with the kid and Kate. And
do you need me to have Kate leave so you can tell me how you really been?
Help me!
Yeah. He's writing "Help me" on a pad in front of him, folks.
Yeah, I'm like tapping.
She's like, blink. Say another fucking word, you cock.
he's like, blink twice if you need help.
Oh, please. No.
So this week we are covering the 1986 film, The Fly.
Wow, you really just cut him off like that, huh?
Yeah.
See, it goes beyond the home with Kate cutting me off. It's Travis doesn't give a shit about what I have to say either.
I wouldn't know where.
Why am I even here?
Wow, bub.
Too loud.
So 1986, The Fly. And don't worry, Kate, because your time is coming. We are going to attack you on this episode. Directed by David Cronenberg. Now, we haven't covered a David Cronenberg film, I don't believe, but we covered the Brandon Cronenberg film, Possessor. Mm-hmm. Screenplay by Charles Edward Pogue and David Cronenberg, based on The Fly by George Langland. I was actually going to cover this with you early. Do you think, now I haven't read The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. Do you mm-hmm. think that this was definitely inspired by that?
I suppose, I mean, the obvious connection is that it's a man turning into a bug.
A buggy, yeah.
But I would say they're very, very different. Metamorphosis is a lot about like his internal monologue.
More psychological.
Yeah, and it's more psychological and like, is it really happening? Yeah, it's a little different.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have that transformation in common.
Right. Okay, so this is starring the totally unfuckable Jeff Goldblum. Gina Davis,
who
was actually...
dare you?
We're just going to start off by throwing haymakers.
Yeah. Yeah. The buggy Jeff Goldblum before he turns into a bug.
Oh, shit.
a really good-looking Gina Davis, I must say. And John Getz. I'm assuming John Getz is the creepy boss. Music mm-hmm. by Howard Shore. Now, where did that name come up before? Was Howard Shore Candyman? Or was that... He had come up before.
I feel bad because I don't remember, but I think the score for this is beautiful.
Yeah, it really is really good.
Hey, editor Kate here, coming to you from the future. Howard Shore actually worked on the music for The Silence of the Lambs, not Candyman.
So just to get started here, I have some fast facts. It's been a while since we've done like a traditional episode. So this was remade or reimagining, however the hell you want to put it, however the kids are saying it nowadays, because it was based on the that original short story. But it's really kind of a remake of the 1958 monster flick directed by Kurt Newman. David Cronenberg, obviously, this is notably different because it really pushes the body horror and shit. And it's really, you know, the 80s and the way the practical effects of the 80s were going. Obviously, it's a lot different than the 50s version. What is body horror? So we've covered this a couple times on here, but I don't think we've ever done a definition of what body horror is. Just to define body horror for those who aren't familiar, body horror taps into the fear of the unknown, similar to many other categories of horror. Body horror takes that fear and pushes it a little bit further, though, instead focusing on our loss of something or corruption, bastardizing something that is supposed to be ours. Our body, our purity, our image, infection, mutation, sickness, or any form of abnormalities to a grotesque effect often, and then the psychological aftermath of losing power or control of something that is supposed to be ours. Megan Navarro actually explains this better than I think I ever could in her article, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid, An Intro into Body Horror on Bloody Disgusting. She explains, body horror overlaps and blends well with other subgenres of horror and offers more internal depth than just outward body transformations. It may have begun rooted in conscious fears of losing control of our own bodies as the characters on screen lost control of theirs via mutilation, transformation, or decomposition. Now it can reflect our medical fears, unwanted change, technological fears, and even fears of natural growth. So that's a little intro on body horror. Number two of the fast facts is David Cronenberg. David is a pillar of horror. Like I said, this is the first film that we've covered for him, but I'm sure it will not be the last. A pillar of horror, I should say, like John Carpenter, Wes Craven, you know, all these other guys. With films like Scanners, Shivers, Rabid, The Brood, The Fly, Videodrome. Have you ever seen Videodrome?
Nope.
You would probably really dig that one, too. David became a favorite director for a lot of horror and sci-fi heads during the late 70s and 80s. Because of his politically charged and incredibly gory but smart, seething social satire films. In an era where more was better, quote, was the mantra, and the special effects masters were in their prime, Cronenberg's brand of horror was just the right flavor at the right time. Number three, Typhoon the Baboon was very frightening on set. Apparently during the scene in the telepod, the baboon became frightened by the flashing lights and broke out of the container. It was apparently Jeff Goldblum's frame standing at 6'4 of man beef who was able to calm Typhoon down. Yeah. Yeah. But apparently he was the only guy on set that was able to calm down the monkey or the ape.
Yeah.
What was it? Yeah.
Baboons are apes.
Baboon.
Yeah, who cares? But, Jeff Goldblum was considered a risky move. to cast as the lead because the studio thought that he wasn't bankable enough.
Wrong.
This given to his weird, monkey fly-esque frame. Other actors up for the role included Michael Keaton. Would have been better.
Wrong.
William Dafoe.
Would have absolutely crushed it.
And wait for this one. And Mel Gibson.
Bleh.
Please, bud. Okay, so the last one here. Comedy legend Mel Brooks was a producer on this film, but kept it largely a secret. He didn't want filmgoers to have any thought that The Fly was going to be, at all comedic. He actually came up with the film's tagline, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid, during a production meeting. So, with the fast facts out of the way, Brooks, I want to get your first initial thought. First initial, view of The Fly.
I'm not going to lie. All I can think about is Michael Keaton right now. Oh, I think he would have absolutely smashed this role.
Yeah, but.
I mean, I'm not a Goldblum hater.
No, I'm not either.
I'm not a Goldblum hater.
I'm not either.
He did a good. I mean, he does look like a fly a little bit. He so does. That he totally nailed
his
it.
His eyes are like on the side of his head.
Gosh.
Can drive a truck through him.
Just to get this out of the way, though. Kate, during this movie.
Oh my god, dude!
When he walks during several scenes in this movie, you can tell her thought was completely off. Like when he comes out of the telepod, and he's wearing nothing else and stuff. God. And they barely don't show his package and stuff.
Yeah.
Katie and Rose are not even thinking at that point.
Oh, no. They were no.
I've always loved Jeff Goldblum.
Yes,
I've always thought he's hot.
We were reminded of that 15 times throughout the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of him to see in this film.
Oh, by the way, chime in the comments if you think Jeff Goldblum is a sex icon, because Kate and Rose do.
You guys are going to be put to shame in the comments.
Well, yeah. See, I think there's going to be a lot of feedback that says yes, he is. I think I'd be curious.
You guys are honestly just jealous. Like, let's really put it out there.
Yeah, we're going to be wrong.
Yeah, I'm so insecure.
Michael Keaton's hotter though.
Yeah. Both hot different ways.
So much. Title of this episode is Jeff Gold. This is the Jeff Goldblum podcast.
I was just going to say, so much for talking about the movie. It's just going to be a debate about Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park Goldblum or The Fly Goldblum?
Oh, that's
Jurassic. Oh, I can answer that.
Yeah,
no, he's way hotter in Jurassic Park.
I'm pretty sure you brought that up about 3 times during the movie too.
Can't help it.
There's a lot of anger coming through on Brooks' side.
I know
too.
He's a little jealous.
Yeah,
I'm sleeping on the couch tonight. It's over.
Yeah, he's like, thanks for bringing it up. We fought for 2.5 hours after you guys left.
Oh God.
Okay.
So yeah.
With that out of the way.
Deep breath.
To be fair, you guys had your own comments about how hot Gina Davis is in this film.
Yeah,
we said it one time.
when she first appeared, I was like, yeah, well, she's really good looking here.
Yeah, speaking of when she first appeared, she was wearing a leather jacket, leather skirt, and shiny silk purple shirt. It was very 80s with the hair.
And like
it really sets the tone because they came in on, like, they're in the convention and stuff. And I was just like, I work with a lot of scientists, like researchers and stuff, and I was just like, I wish research conventions had this many hotties. Like, it ain't like that.
It's like we're watching the movie again.
Oh, my God. See, it comes up again. Jesus. Here, let's just put this right in front of Kate, back of this episode.
Yeah, just give her the... Oh, God.
All right.
It's like, dude, they're pushing it even on the back of the fucking case.
You're going to have to get her a poster.
All right, so, Brooks, your first thoughts about The Fly.
I'm glad you brought up body horror, because when we were watching this movie, I felt like I was watching an 80s version of, like, a Marvel origin story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't feel like a horror movie to me. Like, even when he was fully transitioning into, like, full-on fly mode, I didn't find any of it particularly horrifying or freaky or whatever. Like, yeah, it's freaky because of a man turning into a fly, but, like, I didn't really see this as a horror flick. I felt it more like sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, but, like, it was definitely an entertaining movie. Like, it was cool to see, like, you know, because obviously it was a slow burn, like, for him to be, like, begin the process of becoming a fly. It was enjoyable to see that build up to kind of try to figure out, like, what was going to happen. I mean, you can kind of probably guess it before even seeing it, but
right.
Once that, you know, fly fusion happens, then you start seeing the degradation after that. It became really enjoyable there. I just enjoyed seeing his transition, really.
Oh yeah.
And you don't I thought it was cool.
And you don't really know how far they're going to take it until they do. But yeah.
Like, even at the climax at the end, it was just like this, like, just full on, like, epic transition into this, like, beast. And, like, I didn't think that they were going to do something like that extreme, because the whole movie was just like these slow changes, especially with how much they, like, skip time throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they'll have a scene and then it's like undetermined amount of time in the future happens. And then in this, like, climactic end scene, it's just like all of a sudden he just, you know,
absolutely
becomes this massive fly.
Absolutely.
So, did you say whether or not you liked it?
I did like it. I said I thought it was an enjoyable movie. Mm-hmm. It's not like my favorite movie I've seen, but I don't, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say it sucked. Like, it was a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I thought it was a really good movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
It wasn't my favorite, though. No.
Was this your second time watching it, you said?
Yeah. So, this is my second time watching it. I can't remember how old I was when I saw it the first time. I know my mom introduced me to this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely forgot some scenes. So, I think she might have fast-forwarded through some, because I might have been a little too young. Mm-hmm. She might have fast-forwarded through some just to, like, sort of save me from nightmares, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
But I do remember most of it. And when I rewatched it, like, I don't know about you, Brian, but I, like, as an adult seeing it, got the sense, like, pretty early on, like, I'm watching a classic. I just get that feel. The storytelling is so good. You're watching, like, at its core, a relationship, like, the evolution of a love story.
Mm-hmm,
happen, and it's so well done, honestly. I think it almost, like, not that I would make it any other way. Mm-hmm. But the whole, you know, the whole science part and him turning into a fly and all of like the kind of shocking, again, the body horror, like the special effects that you're seeing can almost distract you from, and we'll talk about the themes later, but it can distract you from some of these like really powerful themes, mm-hmm. Which I think is why I like this movie so much. Like, it's definitely a classic for me.
Now, seeing this after seeing his son's film Possessor, can you see kind of how his son is going, like, definitely in his father's footsteps? Or
yeah, I mean, I guess you can't grow up with a great storyteller and not become one yourself. He certainly didn't. His son certainly didn't lick it off the ground. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have very similar styles in that they pick like some really heavy topics, really heavy themes, and they're telling a compelling story, and then they're shocking you with that body horror, you know, like with the special effects and the violence and stuff, which is pretty cool.
Oh yeah, and this is an example of like a kind of movie that we were raised on, like me and my brother. Like, my dad always loved these monster movies and guys kind of trying to make something happen, and then it's almost like death is better, like in a lot of these kind of movies, and you kind of get what you ask for. We follow this character, and he's really trying to make something happen, like I just said, and like it's really like a tragic story, and it's a really beautiful like movie for me. To touch on Goldblum, like, I actually think this is his best performance, like, as far as like, I really, really like him in this movie. Like, I think he's amazing in this movie. Like,
yeah, as a lead character, he does a really great job. Yeah. I just thought as he was transitioning in particular, like his, like, he was literally buzzing, mm-hmm. you know, like a fly, and like becoming manic. And like, I just felt like his performance had a lot of depth. Gina Davis's, especially at the end, mm-hmm. I thought was like pretty powerful performance from both of them. I thought they did great.
And like, I feel like this is like the classic Goldblum, like persona, like personality that in this character too, because he's like very charismatic and like very charming and all this stuff. So like, him in that role, I thought was really good. Mm-hmm. It's just very fitting of him, for sure.
You know what? You brought up like a Marvel superhero earlier, and that really, don't take this the wrong way, but it shocked me that you brought that up. But it also made a lot of sense, because this is almost like a dark take on like a Fantastic Four story or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really, or like a Spider-Man, if he were really going like to turn into a spider.
If the fly would have actually lived, like this could have been like the, you know, like Bruce Banner getting, you know, dipped in radiation, you know, it's like, this is how he became a fly. And then, you know, if he had gone on and became a supervillain or whatever, like, you know,
Baxter Stockman from TMNT.
Yeah. You would have had this backstory.
Yeah.
That's why this kind of reminded me of something like that, just because of, you know, looking into what the future that could have been, mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Kate, this has become kind of like a running little segment on the show. Do you want to go through like kind of the story?
Sure. Yeah. So if you haven't seen this film, we're going to walk you through. So spoilers ahead. I think we did pretty good not mentioning it, mm-hmm. for a little bit. So this movie starts out and you meet Jeff Goldblum's character, who's called Seth Brundle. And he is at a science convention and he's talking to Gina Davis's character, who's named Veronica. She is a reporter, and he kind of doesn't know it. She assumes he knows she's a reporter, and so there's like that unknown kind of there. And he's like, hey, they're kind of hitting it off, and she definitely was looking for a story, and he's like, hey, do you want to go and see something cool? And she's like, okay, and follows him to this warehouse. It looks really creepy and abandoned, and like, her I'm gonna get murdered radar should have been going off.
Oh yeah.
And she goes in anyway, and it's his apartment. Like, he just is like an eccentric kind of researcher guy. He's clearly pinching pennies and, you know, living in a way that facilitates his research only. Like, he wears the same clothes all the time, you know, a la Steve Jobs and many other scientists. I think he mentions Einstein did that too. He sleeps on a sofa bed. Like, his life revolves around this research he's doing. And you find out that he has created these telepods, as he calls them. And like, his research has been, and what he's been trying to create is a way to teleport. And he's only managed to teleport inanimate objects at this point. Like, he hasn't successfully gotten any living tissue to go through, whether it's a steak, as you see, or an animal or a human.
A baboon.
Yeah, baboon. So he shows her the technology. She's like, oh my God, this is an awesome story. He's like, wait, you can't put this story out. Like, you'd ruin me. And so she goes back to her editor, and the editor's like, eh, he's working you. He was just trying to get you in bed. And she's like, you're wrong. So you find out her ex is her editor.
The ultimate creeper.
Yeah, he...
Stathis. Like, what the fuck kind of...
Yeah, so he is garbage. He clearly was a very controlling person, and he has many creepy lines throughout. Ooh. Where he says stuff like... And he still, like, tries to use her for sex, even though she's, like, very clearly drawn a line under their relationship and said it's done. So he's got a very controlling, creeper, stalkery vibe. Like, he even kept the key to her apartment and shows up and takes a shower there when she's not there.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's...
That scene was weird.
Like, he's definitely a person you don't want to have around, but she's kind of stuck with him because he's her editor and she's just going with it. But anyway.
And yet realistic, right? Because, like it, during, given the time, like, we've seen all this bullshit come out, like, recently. It's like... How many women were going through that shit in the 80s? How many women go through that now? So it's like...
Yeah, at that time, women were expected to just, like, you know, suck it up and deal with it, you know. Yeah, and nowadays, you would report that stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, anyway, so she has these two relationships going on, right? She's very attracted to Seth, and she wants to learn more. And Seth happens to come in to the office where she's meeting with her editor to sell the story. And he's like... You can't do the story, of course. He just keeps reiterating this. And he's like, let me take you out to eat. He says, like, I've got one word for you, cheeseburger, which is cute. And so they go out to a diner and they have lunch. And he's explaining to her, this is why you can't do it. They both kind of agree together. She's going to have the exclusive on the story, of course. And they're going to film and record. And, you know, she's going to collect all of the things that she would need to report on this along the journey of him finally being able to... perfect the telepods and take it to market, etc. They spend a lot of time together, of course, doing all this and form a pretty strong relationship. They have sex and become kind of girlfriend boyfriendy. And then, of course, here comes the editor. Here comes the creepy ex-boyfriend creeping in on her story, trying to, you know, make waves. So she leaves one night. They're meant to be celebrating him getting the baboon. Okay, so they get a baboon to go through the telepod.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out the other side alive, right? And so they're meant to be celebrating this. And she's like, I gotta go end, like, this bullshit with my ex once and for all. And she's like, we'll celebrate later. And while she's gone, Seth gets so drunk. And he's, like, spiraling out. He's got these jealous feelings, and he's feeling like, oh, she could be betraying me. Like, I've got to... And in his mind, he's a narcissist, right? So he's like, what can I do to get her to be more impressed with me, to love me more, to spend her time with me and see that I'm the better choice, you know? Mm-hmm. And, of course, being intoxicated doesn't help all of this. And he's, like, this arrogant scientist who is... drunk, in love, he's got a lot of shit going on, and he's like, okay, I have the way to do this. And he speeds up his process that he was not typically, like, he wasn't on the track to do this, right? But he did it anyway. He goes into the pod, doesn't realize there's a fly in the pod with him. Only one thing can go in at once.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't, like, he was so drunk he didn't realize, and he goes through, and so does the fly, and they fuse together. Like, their genetics actually fuse together. Of course, he doesn't know this at the time. And he comes out the other side, and then he's got all of the... He's starting to, you know... He tells her, and she's like, oh my God, that's amazing. Then they start to worry, right? Because he's... Well, Gina starts to worry. He thinks he's becoming a superhero, basically.
Yeah.
Because he's, like, able to do all these feats of strength, and it's wild.
He was, like, doing gymnastics in the lab, you know?
Yeah.
Like, doing a handstand on the chair and...
Right.
He broke that motherfucker's arm in the bar, dude. Oh.
Oh, yeah, dude, that was a nice
right,
scene.
So just so I don't, to, you know, talk about every single scene in my, kind of more detailed synopsis, but essentially, from that point, they find out from the computer that it fused their genetics together, and he realizes and almost comes, like, kind of manic and is, like, thinking and acting more like a fly, right? Like, just very fast and frenetic, and he's just like, I don't know, he's almost acting like he needs to mate and he needs to this, and like an more like an insect, you know, operating on instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets control of that somehow. I don't really know when that happened, but it's just this de-evolution of him, and he becomes, I guess evolution of him, and his relationship with Gina Davis, because she is like, she pops in to check on him throughout the way. She's very worried about him, and it just, he transforms more and more and more mentally, physically. By the end, like, some other things happen that she realizes she's pregnant. There's a whole, you know, abortion scene, and
that
then,
seems fun.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the very final scene, which I won't talk about, but it ends very tragically, is all mm-hmm. I'll say before we discuss. But that is essentially the movie. It's mm-hmm. Honestly pretty brilliant.
And I will say, like, him gradually losing his, and maybe this is a good time to start talking about like the themes and stuff, we can go around, but I really dug the performance in Goldblum as he gradually loses his humanity, like the little tics and stuff. It starts out very, very like almost unconscious and stuff, and he really like owns this role, like it. And I know I said that before, but like if you just watch the movie, like the little tics of his mouth, like him licking, like the little tics of his eyes and stuff, like he becomes more and more insect as he goes. But that shit is just so like, and that's one of the big themes that I caught on with this film, was his losing of his humanity, like psychologically, like his bodily, you know, losing of his humanity and stuff. But yeah, what themes did you guys catch on to with this movie?
His evolution, de-evolution, whatever you want to call it, into a fly was almost like a, like as a human getting like a terminal illness
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
you just can't shake.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, you're powerless against what it can do to you. So you start losing your faculties, and, you know, just the disease takes over, and then, you know, it ultimately kills you. Whereas him becoming a fly was never going to be sustainable. I mean, obviously it was, he could live on as a fly, of course, but like it would just wouldn't be right. And so that you kind of go down that journey.
Yeah.
And,
to piggyback on that whole physical comparison, like to him turning into a fly, like Brian's spot on in that
mm-hmm.
Observation that it's like, for instance, getting a terminal kind of cancer or any other kind of disease that, you know, breaks your body down.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the psychological aspect that comes with that process, right? Because mm-hmm. this at its core, of course, there's a love story, and it's about dying. This movie's about the process of realizing you're dying, not being able to do anything about it, trying to manically cope, find a way to change it, try to predict how your life is going to, like, how your prognosis is going to go, like how the rest of your life is going to happen before you finally do die. Ultimately feeling, again, powerless. And then you also see the perspective of the, not just the person going through it, like struggling to cope and accept this fate, but you also are seeing Gina Davis's character, Veronica, as the person who loves someone who's got this terminal fate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like she loves him. She's worried about him. She's watching him deteriorate, and it's horrifying and traumatizing to her. All you want to do is help ease their pain, or to help him get, like, go to the, she was like, you have to go to the hospital and have them run tests. And he's like, my genes were spliced with a fly. What are they going to do? This mm-hmm. never happened, you know? Yeah. And so it's like that kind of bargaining. So you're going through the process of grief with the both of them, and they're both experiencing obviously very different kinds of grief, like pre-grief really, cause he's not dead yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately I don't want to talk about the end just yet, cause I think it's such a incredible scene, but anyway,
for sure.
But yeah, I think that's like a huge core theme that Brian picked up on really well, and I think that's
for sure,
that's one of my favorite things about this film.
And then the like you brought up, like a debilitating, or however you say that,
debilitating
disease, or what, you know, whatever, it can also work as like a a metaphor for like a drug addict or like an alcoholism or something. Like you want to help them, but you're kind of just watching them like die, like gradually.
Yeah, you're watching them.
I really picked up on that.
Hit a rock bottom, yeah.
But yeah, no, that's good shit, Brooks. Kate, you're the theme queen. Did you have anything else that you kind of picked up on? I know, like, and I'm glad that you brought up the, like, the cancer and the disease stuff, because that was one of the big things that you hit up on Color Out of Space, which was a recent, you know, kind of a body horror type film. But yeah, did you have anything else that you wanted to bring up as far as themes go?
Yeah, so this gets back to the whole central love story of this between Seth and Veronica. So I think at the same time as you're seeing, you know, the nuance and the complexity of, you know, their love and their relationship while he's turning into a fly, but you also just see a lot of things that you normally, like, in a lot of movies, because the time is so short, like, a lot of filmmakers, I don't think, do a great job of showing you that arc the way this movie does. And a lot of others do, but a lot of them kind of just, they give short shrift to the whole building of a connection between two characters, right? They're just like, okay, they're in love. Got it. We're going from there. This is more, tells you the story better, I think. But anyway, you see their process of new love, falling in love, infatuation. You see them experiencing like jealousy and betrayal and stuff like that. And you see Seth's character, because he's also a narcissist. I think I stand by that statement.
Oh, he is, for sure.
You see how, like, at the first signs of any possible struggle in their relationship or issue that you need to overcome together, like, his nature comes out and he becomes manipulative and controlling. The only reason he got into that pod was so that he can manipulate her into staying with him. And
Can I just talk about that scene real quick?
It was super controlling, yeah.
So growing up, I always thought that that was a leap until I grew up and became a man. And now I realize, like, so Brooks, you often have this problem as well. But like as men,
we do. It needs to be said.
But we do like fly off the handle sometimes, and maybe we're just like, fuck it, I'm doing this. Like, and I was like, that scene fucking works now. Like, I understand that scene. He was thinking about it. It was eating away at him, and he was like, fuck it, I'm going through. And it was irrational, and it was dumb, and it made a lot of sense.
Especially because he was drunk, too.
Absolutely.
He's just like, ah, fuck it, you know?
And he was
probably mad that she wasn't, you know.
Absolutely.
She wasn't there, so.
Well, and right, it doesn't excuse what he did or what his intentions were when he did it, which was to manipulate and control.
Absolutely.
Their relationship and her. But at the end of the day, knowing his personality flaw, like, it makes total sense. And when you're watching it, it almost like seems like, oh, he was just drunk and you just want to kind of brush under the rug. But as the movie goes on, you see a lot more of these kind of controlling behaviors coming out as he becomes less human as well, which I think you can put two and two together on that. And then, of course, you see kind of violence in their relationship where he says, like, if you stay, I'll hurt you. On one hand, an admittance of like, I can't control myself and I will hurt you. And he was trying to help her and save her from himself.
I honestly thought that was like a really responsible and mature thing of him to do, though.
Right. But then in the next scene, he's like kidnapping her. You see what I mean? Like, he loses control. And it is this, like, if you take the whole him being a fly away from it, like, or him turning and having this physical thing going on, if he were just a normal man, like, this is a thing that abusers do, right? So, like, they'll say, like, oh, they'll do something abusive, say something abusive, and then they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't believe I did this, and then they try to make you feel sorry for them. And then they abuse, and the abuse just ramps up and gets worse and worse over time, right?
Do you think that there was, like, an element of him, like, when he was doing the whole, I will, you know, if you stay, I will hurt you, was he just trying to, like, cover himself for what he knew he wanted to do?
No.
I mean, I don't think he ever wanted to be violent with her, but
I think you can tell
that he might have, like, wanted to act on these impulses that he was getting, too.
At the end of the day, I think he truly loved her, and she truly loved him. And it was this very toxic love in the end. And you see assisted suicide, where he finally, like, basically asked her by putting the gun to his head. I'm going to say it now.
Oh, for sure.
And is asking her with his eyes, like, Put Me Out of My Misery.
Man, that scene is sad too.
It's a super powerful scene. If you watch it the first time, like, you should get it then, but when you watch it the second time, you get it even more.
Oh yeah.
And then of course I forgot to mention there's an abortion story here. So she finds out she's pregnant, and it's most likely that she got pregnant while his genetics were spliced with the fly. And so all she can think about, she has a fever dream about her having this larva baby.
That scene was wild.
And yeah.
Director David Cronenberg cameo as well as the doctor.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And so, like, you're seeing also some gender gender politics happening, like what it was like in the 80s to try to get an abortion. It's like, well, this is too rushed, sleep on it. And she's like, I don't want it in my body. I don't want it in my body. It's my body. I don't want it.
Little,
like,
body horror there too.
Right. And so, and she needed a man, keep in mind, to find a doctor and to, like, to go with her. Yeah, yeah. And that's legit. That still happens today. You have to have a man with you, your husband with you, or somebody to sign off on something that has nothing to do with them. It's your body. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I won't get into that. Like, I think y'all know my views on it. But anyway, this story is packed. It's packed with themes. It's packed with, like, really important topics. If you just watch it, you know, and you're just letting the movie wash over you, you could be distracted by the fact he's turning into a friggin' fly. And just, like, the horrifying kind of, like, physical things you're seeing happen to him. Like, he's disintegrating and, like, he's vomiting on his food and stuff. Yeah, but...
So anyway. Before I get my horror card totally pulled, we do have to talk about some of those scenes where he's morphing into this big beast of a fly and
of
stuff.
Of course, yeah.
And this was actually an Oscar winner for Best Makeup. The makeup was done by Chris Wallace and Stephen DePew, I believe is how you say it. But yeah, the Oscar winner. So, Brooks, what were some of your favorite, like, special effects moments in this movie? Because this movie, again, is, like, chock full of them. Like, as Katie said, they can
It's so hard to, like, pick one.
Which one's burned in your brain? Like, which one comes first?
I would say the one that kind of made me go, like, the most was when he was in the bathroom and he noticed his fingers changing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, like, he squeezed his index finger and then that, like, white milky substance squirted on the mirror. Mm-hmm. And then he looks and then he kind of sees his nail and he's, like, messing with his nail.
I'm getting...
And then he pulls it up.
I'm getting really nasty feelings right now, even with you describing that scene.
And, like,
when he pulls his fingernails off.
It off and, oh, my. No.
The one that bothers me, too, is the teeth. So, like, right after that, he, like, starts fucking with his teeth. And he starts, like, pulling that out, too. Oh, God.
Yeah, and then, like, his teeth fall out. And then, like, he's just, like, licking his gums. Just, like... You know, just, like, licking the empty space of where his teeth were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just kind of, ugh, that was kind of gross, too. Yeah.
Now, I can tell you I heard an actual response from you during this scene. And it was the scene when the creeper, they go in, him and Gina Davis are going in, and Seth has gone through the telepod, I believe. And the creeper shoots Gina Davis out of the telepod, right, to...
Stathis.
I'm calling him the creeper. And the fly comes out. Seth comes out and he throws up on the dude's arm and then leg.
Yeah.
And Brooks had like a outburst of a reaction because you were just like, oh, and you were like, that's awesome, because it's like he's spitting out this, like, acidy kind of vomit. Like fly and, like, dissolving this dude's leg.
Yeah, because he described that earlier. Like, he made a video of when he was realizing that he couldn't eat, like, solid food anymore, and he was, like, becoming a fly because they have to, like, regurgitate it, essentially.
Yeah, they vomit on something and it breaks it down and then they slurp it up.
Yeah.
Just a quick aside, I thought that they did a really good job of having the mad scientist explain to you, the viewer, like, the kind of the nature of the insect. Like, in case you don't know anything about flies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they do a really good job of just, like, slipping it in. And in the way they did that is basically being like, he's a mad scientist explaining this to Gina. Mm-hmm. Or, sorry, her name is Veronica. Explaining it to Veronica. And as a viewer, it's very helpful to you because you notice he's eating candy. Flies love sugary things.
They go for sweet.
Yeah.
He's always eating chocolate.
He's eating trash.
Yeah. Yeah, and he... something that got me and it gave me kind of the shivers a little bit, and it's related to the whole vomiting and eating. It's like what Brian brought up when in the scene where he's filming himself, like, for posterity and for, you know, to record everything. And he's almost like talking as if like, okay, kids, like, kids are going to be watching this. It's crazy. It's like, here's like, let me demonstrate it for you. And they don't show it. But you can hear it. You can hear him vomit on something and slurp it up.
Ew.
And that gave me just like the shivers. Cause the sound of it was enough to make me feel the heebie-jeebies. Like, imagine if they had showed it. Like, I don't know. Maybe it would make it look too funny.
Yeah.
But either way, I love that too.
Yeah, the fact that he's like attracted to trash and stuff. Do you think he's a Dallas Cowboy fan like me? Maybe I'm like that. Yeah. So let's talk about the ending and then we'll close it out, because we talked about the gore scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. So Kate, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay. Sure. So basically, this is how the end goes, and then we'll chat about it. Right. So the climax begins, or like the final arc begins, when she's in the abortion clinic about to get an abortion and isn't able to do that because Seth comes, like, what did you say? He comes in through the wall like
the Kool-Aid man.
Like the Kool-Aid man. Yeah, which is true. He just like busts through this like 80s glass cube wall, and he scoops her out a la King Kong and takes her off to his warehouse. And from there, like, he's in this very manic state where he hasn't completely transformed into the fly yet, so he's still got some human aspects.
Yeah, he's kind of like a humanoid fly.
Yeah, he's a humanoid fly. He's definitely got the strength and he can scale walls and all these things, but yeah, so he whisks her off, and he's like telling her in this very manic way, he's like, we're going to become one. Like, you can't get rid of our baby. I'm going to keep us together forever. We're going to become one, whatever, whatever. So his plan is to put her in a pod and him in the other pod and fuse them together, which is just so crazy, right?
Just fucked up.
Like, it wouldn't accomplish anything. It would just be really, really strange and really, like, it would basically be ending them both.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a murder-suicide, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's a good sort of decoy to make you feel like the ex-boyfriend is going to be the hero. So ex-boyfriend shows up.
Yeah, he's the good guy.
He gets vomited on, and he somehow manages to still use the gun, but not on Seth, right? So he is able to use the gun to get Gina, to get Veronica out of the pod, out of the telepod. And you think he's going to be the hero, but it's not the case. Because while she is able to get out, like, the pod is like malfunctioning because he shot a hose or something. And then you realize that now Seth's character, so Seth is in the pod and he starts to bust out of the pod when he sees the commotion happening. And so he actually gets fused in the process, because it had already begun. He gets fused with the telepod itself, and he comes out as like part fly, because at this point he is a fly. He transforms into a fly. His eyes are like a fly. He has almost no human
there's nothing physical human about him left.
Yeah, no physical human features left other than his size.
Mm-hmm.
But you come to learn, he comes out and he's like, his eyes look like pleading. He obviously can't move because he's got like weird, you know, telepod material coming out of his body. Like, he clearly is not going to live. He's surely suffering. Veronica picks up the shotgun, and she knows what she needs to do, but she's just like, she still loves this man. It's still tragic what's happening, and she knows that what he's doing to her is not what he would do if he were fully human, maybe. Mm-hmm. But she's just completely torn up, and that's when he, as I mentioned before, he takes the gun in his hand and puts it to his head, which is basically telling her, please put me out of my misery, do it. And his eye, like, the way that affects people made those eyes look so emotional, because they're not real, right? They're just this, they're the effect.
They were awesome.
Yeah, they're whatever they created, however they did it, animatronics or I don't know.
It's probably just practical,
yeah. But either way, so she finally pulls the trigger, ends his life, and the movie ends right there. It like goes black, and you hear her sobbing, and that is the end.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think, Brian, as our special guest?
Well, I have to kind of, what's the word?
Oh, Brooks is going to laugh at it or something.
No, because I have to recant what I did when we were watching the movie, because I was just like kind of being trolly and being like, oh, come on, you know, like I was kind of almost like making fun of her for being so sad.
Emotional.
Yeah. Emotional about it. Because, like, it's in that moment, like, before you take time to reflect, like, maybe I'm just kind of a jerk, though. Because I was just like, I am. Like, I'm, I don't know. My emotions are, we won't talk about that. But, like, I was viewing it as, like, okay, like, it's obvious this dude is, like, he's at the point of no return. It's like, you just gotta put him down. Like, I was being kind of, I'm not gonna lie, I was being kind of heartless about it on first watch. You know, put me in that situation, I probably would react like her too, because you're just at that final, you know, in the grief stage, you're like forced to have to accept what is reality now. So, you know, now that a day has passed and I've been thinking about this movie since we watched it, and honestly, hell, when we first started talking about this, I was like, I don't know. Like, now that we're talking about this a lot deeper, when you start talking about these things, I'm starting to, like, really appreciate this movie a lot more.
I think as we're talking about it. I think if you watch it a second time, you'll definitely, like, it will become, maybe not a favorite, but it'll become a classic.
No, like, I even in the last 20 minutes, I have already really respect this a lot more. I was just being stupid before, I think.
So I have a question for you. If it were me, I'd turn into this fly.
Oh, I'd kill you in a second.
Yeah.
I'd shoot you right between the eyes. But
would you even feel bad about it? Would you even feel sad?
Honestly, I think what would be harder for me is the buildup. Like you called it, like, pre-grief before, because, like, you can see the writing on the wall that this is not going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a lot harder for me to deal with. Just thinking about, like, okay, like, if this happened today, I'd be like, oh my God, I have a almost 2-year-old that I, you know, I got to raise alone now. I'd be thinking about all the ways in my life that, like,
wow, selfish. I thought you had a heart there for a second.
No, but it's true though. Like, you know, I'm obviously, yeah, I love you and I would miss you that you're gone. But, like, you got to think about the life that you got to build afterwards, too. And we get married because we picture each other in it for a long time. And you got to now picture your life without your person. And it sucks. And, you know that this is gonna end. But at the end of the day, like, I would like to hope that... I'm not going to lie. I've never had anybody in my life that's had, like, a long-term terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had an aunt that had breast cancer that ultimately took her life, but I would never say that we were super, super close. Like, we got along well, and I was young when she passed, so, like, I never really developed, like, that super close bond. I loved her and everything, but, like, outside of her, like, all the people that were the closest to me have all died very suddenly.
Yeah.
So, like, I've never had to deal with that extended grief period, but... I think that if I was in her position, I would try my very best, as best I can handle, to work on accepting what's going to happen. And then when that drop me in that position where he is full on fly, he wants you to put him down, I would like to hope that I can follow through.
Well, and she did.
I mean, I think her progression was really cry and all that, but, like, you have to do it. Like, you have to be strong enough to realize that's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And she did. So I think her progression with him was, like, accurate to life, right? Of someone who loves another person and is watching them deteriorate, lose themselves, lose their faculties, and ultimately get to a point where they're so desperate to die that they're asking you to help them die.
Well, and think about this, and this works as well. It's not the same kind of path, but think about the animal. We've all had to choose to put an animal down in here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the choice that you have to make, like, it takes time for you to decide how to do that and, like, to come to terms with it, to, like, actually pulling the trigger, you know, no pun intended.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, pulling the trigger to make that happen. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, with Smudge, you guys with Loki and mm-hmm. stuff like that. At the end of the day, it's like, okay, so death is better than living with that, like, or living, you know, this way kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's what that ending means to me and why it's, like, incredibly emotional. Like, you know, that ending scene. But yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful ending scene.
It's definitely very moving for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because yeah, you see, like, so much love between those two in that moment, like her holding the gun to him and, like,
I think she does a great job of bringing a lot of emotions all in one. It's not just, like, love and sadness and grief, but it's also like pity and devastation. Like you just see it all across her face, and just this realization and acceptance of what she has to do. Like it all, like she does such a good job. You really watch her face if you ever watch that scene again. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have much more to say, but before we end the topic, mm-hmm. There is a documentary called How to Die in Oregon. It will make you cry. It's extreme, like, it's really, really devastating documentary. But anyway, it's the topic of the documentary is assisted suicide. And in Oregon, if you have a terminal illness and you are very, very ill and you are going to die, they have a law that allows you to work with your doctor, get the meds you need to, they assist you in, basically they give you the meds and the doses and how you need to do it if you want to end your life and go out with dignity, essentially. Mm-hmm. Seth does not go out with dignity mm-hmm. In this movie, but while I was watching this whole scene play out, and well, honestly, this whole movie play out, that it kind of reminded me of this documentary. So I highly encourage you to go watch it, because you do follow a few actual people in real life in the documentary who have these terminal illnesses, and you watch them deteriorate, you watch them suffer, and you see their families and what it's doing to them, and ultimately, of course, you don't see it with your own eyes, but like anyway, just watch it, and you get to the end, and the obvious conclusion is what you think it is, and
on one
it's
hand,
just it's totally devastating, and it can help, and it really can help you get this like empathy, even if you've never gone through it, like Brian said, if you've never gone through mm-hmm. this with anyone in your life that's close to you, it can really like help you find the empathy to sort of feel what those people might be feeling and what Veronica might have been.
And this may be obvious, but like the layer of it, of that scene, is Seth making his final like human decision as mm-hmm. well. So it's like you said about dignity, like he doesn't die in dignity, but he does too, because he's like, no, this is mine to do. Like, you know, mm-hmm. he grabs the gun. He's like, no, this is like what's going to happen. Like,
yeah. Kind of thing. I love how they ended
this
it.
This is what I want.
Yeah. I love that they didn't have him going like for one more big like, jump. Rah! One more jump scare. Oh,
that would have ruined it.
Like a blaze of glory.
Yeah, that would have ruined it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
that's true.
Why don't we go around and give our final thoughts and stuff?
Sure.
So, Brooks, what's your final thought? First of all, did you like this better than Thing? And like other movies, where would you rank this as far as other movies that you've joined us for?
Well, I'll put it this way. Walking into the room today, my opinion of this movie was, it was never low. Let me just start there. I really enjoyed watching this movie, but I watched it and I was like, all right, like that was a solid movie, but like it wasn't, I think I even said it a little earlier. It's like, yeah, it wasn't my favorite thing that we watched. Mm-hmm. But now that we've discussed it, like I realize that I was just maybe not paying close enough attention, or like
maybe the 80s production was throwing.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I was just being a little like movie elitist of, you know, not, you know, they were 80s effects. So it was,
and it was
I
like a guy turning into a fly.
Yeah. Like, I mean, let's be honest, a guy turning into a fly is kind of silly, but like maybe those factors were kind of just taking my focus off of what was really important with this. Mm-hmm. And our discussion about it has really changed my opinion for the better. This is one I definitely need to watch again, maybe in a few months. Mm-hmm. And just really, you know, knowing all the things we've talked about, watch it with a different appreciation. And I think I will like, because like I said, when we watched it, I really enjoyed the watch. Like it was a great watch. But I, like all the things it brings to the table is a lot more impressive to me now.
Mm-hmm.
What would you rate it?
Well, then I still got to answer Travis's question about this or The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's hard, but I still think I give The Thing a slight edge.
I think I would too.
I love this movie, though, too.
But it's a lot closer. It's a lot closer.
That's fair.
The Thing was amazing.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of my favorite things you've had me watch. I mean, I watch all the movies that you guys talk about on here, but that was one of probably my favorites.
Yeah.
I think the effects in this one are better. But anyway, what would you rate it?
It's pretty awesome. Probably a solid 4 out of 5. That might even be too low.
That's fair. It's
whatever you want.
Yeah. Because I was, when I walked in, I was like, I'll probably say like 3.5.
You're like, Cronenberg's a hack, bud.
Like, let's break it down from a fundamental standpoint here. But no, I'd say 4 out of 5.
Mm-hmm. Fun fact, John Carpenter actually thinks that Cronenberg's an elitist asshole.
Nice.
Maybe he is.
Since you said fun fact, I want to tell you something. Yesterday, I was on my computer, and I was like scrolling through Twitter because I wasn't working. And there was an article that I saw in my feed of, it was something like the 50, it was like movies that were too gruesome that people had to leave the theater or something like that. Mm-hmm. And The Fly was on that list. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's, and I wasn't expecting to see that. You know, I think at the time, like the effects in this probably would have made some people really kind of grossed out and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, even Katie said like there was scenes that kind of gave her the heebie-jeebies a little bit. And I just thought that was kind of a neat little fun fact because I was like, oh, yeah, I saw The Fly show up in something I just happened across on Twitter.
Oh, but if you had anything, I know people that have like weird things about teeth or fingernails. And that scene.
Yeah. I do. Absolutely do.
But I could totally see if somebody had a weird thing about teeth, they're like, yeah, I'm out. Like, I can't do it.
I mean, the fingernails thing was pretty gnarly, too.
Yeah.
Well, his ear falls off. Yeah. Like,
oh, we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah. I have a thing about teeth. I have recurring dreams that my teeth are falling out. It's
yeah, I remember when we first started dating, like you said, one of the things that was like one of physical feature that was most important to you were teeth.
Yeah.
And you were like so happy that I had braces at one point. And then you're like, oh, you care about your teeth.
All
right.
I can't wait until my teeth actually do fall out so I can get all golds. Dude, anyway, that's different. And I'm serious about that.
I'll just bust my teeth out now so I can get like, some veneers.
I can't
so
wait.
Let's roll.
West side.
I can't wait.
Okay. Get a grill.
Okay. So, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious because of how passionately I talk about this film. I love it. It's 5 out of 5 for me. It's a classic. I don't think I would ever get bored watching it. I'm sure if I watched it a third time, I'd catch more subtle things that I didn't catch even this time. So it's one of those. I think it's got a lot of depth. It's got a lot of message in it. It's fun to break down. And like the effects are great. What was it? Like a tight 90 minutes?
Yeah, it wasn't something like that. Yeah, it wasn't that long.
Yeah,
it was almost 2 hours, I think.
Yeah, there's like at no point was I like move the story along. It's just
95 minutes.
95 minutes. Yeah, I was almost on. But yeah, I really don't have much else to say other than it's a great one and watch it if you haven't.
So yeah, this would be a 4.5 out of 5 for me. Like, and this is the movie that. Like, this is one of the movies, type of movies that I was raised on, and it's one of the reasons why I love these tragic monster characters. They were brought up a couple times, like somebody brought up King Kong, I believe it was you, Katie, but mm-hmm. That's why I adore these original monsters, like the, and because they're all tragic, like Frankenstein, King Kong, the creature from the Black Lagoon, they all share this, like, tragicness about it. And you're able to take these serious topics and get like a really good look at them through the veneer or the eyes of a monster movie. But yeah, a 4.5 out of 5 for me. I absolutely love this movie. And maybe we will reconvene to find out what happens to the son of Brundlefly in The Fly number 2. But
well, there you go. She keeps the baby. Baby Brundlefly.
Not directed by Cronenberg and not nearly as classic, but I still dig it. That's a Donnie Yabara joint. That's a Donnie Yabara favorite, if that tells you anything. Special effects. But anyway, Brooks, I want to thank you for joining us and stuff. This was a really good conversation on this body horror classic. Kate, as always, the theme queen.
Thank you.
yeah, that'll be all. As always, you can find us at HorrifyingMF on Twitter and at HorrifyingMyFriends on Instagram and Facebook. Ooh, I do have a book recommendation. Thank you, Brooks. So this book recommendation is Black Hole from Charles Burns. So this is a indie classic comic. I think this came out in the 80s or 90s, but like I said, it's an indie classic. So as you can see, the body horror on display there.
Oh, yeah.
Little, nice. But I'll read from here.
He was showing us the cover, or the inside.
Yeah, so this
jacket.
Is the winner of the Eisner, Harvey, and Ignatz Awards. Those are like the elite of the elite comic awards. The setting, suburban Seattle, the mid-70s. We learn from the outset that a strange plague has descended upon the area's teenagers, transmitted by sexual contact. The disease manifests itself in any number of ways, from the hideously grotesque to the subtle and concealable. But once you've got it, that's it. There's no turning back. As we inhabit the heads of several key characters, some kids who have it, some who don't, some who are about to get it, What unfolds isn't the expected battle to fight the plague or bring heightened awareness to it or even treat it. What we become witness to instead is a fascinating and eerie portrait of the nature of high school alienation itself. The savagery, the cruelty, the relentless anxiety, the inuity. How do you say that, Kate?
I'm not reading it, but...
E-N-N-U-I. I'm not smart. I went to Ben Davis, for Christ's sakes. The longing for escape. Charles Burns is too smart for me, apparently. The longing for escape. And then the murders start. As hypnotically beautiful as it is horrifying, and that's a common theme of body horror, Black Hole transcends any genre by deftly exploring a specific American cultural moment in flux and the kids who are caught in it. Back when it wasn't exactly cool to be a hippie anymore, but Bowie was still just a little too weird. But yeah, that's Black Hole by Charles Burns. And whoever wrote the synopsis is the smartest man in the universe, apparently.
But, get your dictionary out.
But yeah, thank you for joining us, and I believe that's all I have for you guys tonight.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye.
Fine, my friends.